Hi everyone and welcome to the Genomics Lab podcast, the podcast about current research in the field of genomics.
We are your hosts, Eleanor Watson and Olivia Grant, two PhD students in the genomics group at the University of Essex.
Join us as we speak to researchers in the field about their current research and their journey into genomics. Hello everyone and welcome back to the Genomics Lab. So today, very exciting, we're doing our first bonus episode. So we're doing something a little bit different today. So we're not discussing genomics for once in our lives.
We are having a bit more of a chatty episode today, aren't we, Liv?
Absolutely. We've actually got a beer, both of us.
We have. We've both got a beer. I feel really naughty because it's actually only 5:30.
And the day's gone
a little
so
bit
quick.
The day, haven't we?
The day's gone so quick. I thought I was drinking a beer at like 2 p.m. So I feel a bit weird. But I'm also enjoying it because I don't really have a drink on Monday nights. Well, I never have a drink on Monday nights.
I never have a drink on Monday nights. So this is actually lovely. It's a
maybe we should make it a thing.
We should make it a thing. Monday night, bonus night.
With a beer.
Bonus beer night.
Bonus beer. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, why not?
So how's your week been, Ellie?
It's Monday, but
since our last episode release, which was Wednesday.
Been good. It's been a bit up and down, really. I feel like it's been quite a slow week. Love the snow. I'll be honest, yeah. I set some code to run and I went out and had a little play in it, to be honest.
There's got to be some perks of being a bioinformatician, is that you can just set the code to run and run
exactly
away.
Exactly. Went out, tried to do some sledging, didn't work because I don't have a sledge, just used a tray.
Don't work very well.
And came back and enjoyed looking at the results of all of my coding that I'd left to run.
Love that. Well, my day has been me sat at my computer, staring at my computer, achieving nothing.
A standard Monday, really.
That's a standard Monday for Liv, absolutely. Okay, so today we are discussing something different, like we said. So we are talking to two PhD students, one from De Montfort University and then one from Southampton University, which Ellie loves to discuss.
I love Southampton University. Did my undergrad there. I'm a big
She's a Southampton girl.
Fan of Southampton University, so very happy to have Brad joining us today.
God help us. Right, let's stop rambling and get into the episode then.
Hello to Joe and to Brad. So as we said in the intro, today's episode is a little bit different. So you guys are not in genomics, are you?
No, definitely not.
Disgusting. So, these guys aren't in genomics. They're both PhD students. We said a little bit about them in the intro, but I don't know if you guys just want to, maybe Joe first, just give a little bit or bit of an introduction to you, what you research, where you're doing your PhD and everything like that.
So for me personally, I'm currently studying a PhD in molecular biology and nutrition at De Montfort University, which is in Leicester, for anyone who doesn't know. And I'm particularly interested in different polyphenols and specifically anthocyanins, which is a subclass of polyphenols. It's usually found in the pigments of usually berries. So you got your grapes, elderberries, but most of the research that's been done so far is in red wine. So there was this thing back in the 1980s, the French paradox, it's known as. And they found that even though French people were eating loads of high fat, lots of red meat in their diet, they were still having low risk of cardiovascular diseases. And it was because of the polyphenols in red wine. So I'm just trying to look at different avenues. So I'm specifically interested in elderberry, and I'm working with a company in Italy to investigate. I'm literally in Italy to investigate what is going on for cardiovascular diseases. So that's me. Basically exploring this pathway called ENOS. I don't know if any of you heard of the protein ENOS. It's related to endothelial. So you have this thing called endothelial dysfunction. right? So in any cardiovascular disease, whether you've got diabetes, hypertension, which is high blood pressure, one of the first clinical markers we can see is endothelial dysfunction. Now, there's different drugs for this. You can have a thing called proorganic nitrates. And what this does is it can be intravenous or oral through a gas, and it introduces nitrous oxide back into the body. And nitrous oxide is this vasodilator. It kind of allows the endothelial function to vasodilate, which means you can pump more blood through the body. And then this puts less stress on the body because it's able to flex more. When it's caused constriction, obviously stroke volume and stuff has to increase in order to get the same cardiac output. So it puts the body under a lot of stress. The issue with proorganic nitrates is that they develop endothelial dysfunction in the long term because they bypass all of these mechanisms that induce ENOS. They just bypass it. They skip it. So, and they actually cause oxidative stress anyway. Now, what I'm kind of postulating with the PhD or trying to prove is that anthocyanins, polyphenols, they have like a two-way process, or that's what I'm hypothesizing anyway. One, they increase the pathways to increase nitrous oxide, which causes vasodilation. But at the same time, because of their phenolic structure, so the antioxidants, they can scavenge any reactive oxygen species, so anything that's causing stress in the vasculature. And if you have them two ways, when you reintroduce nitrous oxide, it keeps everything stable again in the vasculature. So that's what I'm trying to prove with the berries. And then if it works, we can then go into human studies and then see if just eating it probably won't. So then we can then look at supplements. We can, you know, make this into a supplement and then give it to participants.
That's really interesting. Brad, do you want to introduce?
Sure. Sorry, hi everybody. Cheers for having me on as well. Being on two podcasts in like 2 months is pretty cool. So yeah, I'm doing a PhD in neuroscience at the University of Southampton. And I specialize in sort of neurodegeneration. So more specifically, whereas a lot of research will look at Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's disease, anything like that, I'm looking at what happens to neuronal health in the absence of disease. So what's happening to our neurons as we're getting towards sort of the later stages of our life? Is there a breakdown in the structure or the way that they work? Because as you know, like even if you don't have disease in old age, you still have sort of like reduced cognitive abilities, you know, struggle with your memory. Like you'll know older people in your family who definitely don't have dementia, but they're not quite as bright as what they were when they were, you know, 50 or so. So I'm going to be looking at, or I am looking at, what processes are going on here. So I'm looking at the neuronal cytoskeleton. So I'm sure that you would have read on the cytoskeleton in any cell in the body. The neurons have slightly more specialized one. So I'm trying to see how that breaks down with normal age and what the sort of output of that could be. And then, so yeah, sort of towards the end of my PhD, what I'm going to be doing is introducing ways to stabilize the cytoskeleton and see if we can increase length of life and sort of quality of life. So can we stabilize the cytoskeleton? Is that going to have a marked improvement? And I use Drosophila. So no sort of cell-based models for me. So I use a proper like organism where I can develop it over time. It's something that you couldn't really do in cell-based studies. They're quite a cool system to work on. And I think the main benefit is if I wanted to do longevity stuff in like, say, a rodent model, I'd have to wait like 2 or 3 years to get the full set of data out. Whereas with Drosophila, I can wait like 8 weeks is sort of the extent of what they live. So I can get a full cycle of data out really quickly.
You guys did obviously a whole podcast on this on Joe's podcast. Joe, you've recently changed the name. So what have you changed it to?
Yeah, no, I've decided to change it to the Research Lounge. The main reason for that is just I felt like, oh, the Festa show just sounded a bit like
Joe felt a bit vain.
Nothing wrong with that.
The research lab, that sounds proper like Zen. I like it.
It fits the vibe, right? It totally fits the vibe. But yeah, so you've changed it to the research lounge. So it's on Spotify and Apple as well. So it's on Anchor, isn't it? So we'll pop the link anyway. But you guys did like a huge, like a whole episode on it, which was really good, by the way. Everyone should go listen to it.
Yeah. So I guess kind of the theme of today's episode was to kind of talk about science communications and social media and that sort of thing, and how obviously important it is, especially as like a young scientist, a student scientist, research scientist. I know you've both got slightly different preferred platforms. We've just forced Brad into making a Twitter account right at the beginning of this episode, actually. So do you want to like just introduce what your preferred platform of choice is and why it's your preferred platform? Joe, you can start.
For me personally, I really enjoy the podcasts. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I like this is because for my podcast channel, speaking to someone when we did our podcast with the two of you, when you speak one-to-one with people and you really get to understand their story on how they got into research, I think that's really inspiring for some people when they're listening back to it, whether they've just started their degree maybe, or master's, or even just started a PhD. I think it's so good to hear someone's story. And when you have a podcast, you've got a whole hour to cover that. And that's been one important thing I've tried to do, is as much as it's good talking about the science, it's good to know how they actually got into the science in the first place. Like for you two, for example, you were both saying how you kind of just fell into the PhD.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and that can be other people's cases. Whereas for someone like myself, it was something I knew I wanted to do when I started. And there's no right or wrong in that. It's just knowing about other people's stories and how you can relate to that.
Yeah, I think you've got a very good point there. I mean, I know definitely as an undergrad, and obviously before undergrad, I didn't really know the next steps in academia. Like I knew you get your degree, but I didn't really know that much about like getting a master's and a PhD. I definitely didn't know what a postdoc was. Like, I know that sounds really silly because when it's so obvious, but I was like, what on earth is a postdoc? And people throw those terminologies around all over the place, don't they? And I think as a really early on in your academic life, it's quite daunting to actually ask someone like, what actually is that? So I think you might be right that having a whole hour to talk about someone and how they actually got to where they are now is definitely a useful tool as a listener in an earlier stage of their academic journey.
I don't think I'd even heard of the term postdoc before I started my PhD, to be honest.
I don't think I had. The only way I'd heard of it was when I was doing my master's. My best friend was doing her PhD at UCL, and she used to talk about the postdocs, and I always used to be like, yeah, because I didn't want to look stupid. I'm like, yeah. I haven't got a clue what they were, but
I don't think I'd ever heard of them. I think as someone who was going into the PhD, I feel like that's, you know, that summer before, I would have loved to like actually hear people's stories and I guess like their own personal experience of what it's like doing a PhD, because I had no idea what I was walking into. And the first couple months, I still didn't know
what we were doing, did we? We just looked at each other like, what have you done today? Should we go for lunch?
Yeah, literally. I was like, am I gonna have exams? I don't even know at this point.
Yeah. And there's so much to a PhD, and I'm sure we can get into that within this podcast. But yeah, for me personally, I think having the podcast and stuff is very important for one, for people who want to do a PhD, and for two, people like ourselves who are already doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So we know Brad isn't going to say Twitter.
I don't know. It might be a really fast favorite. He might have loved it in the last half an hour.
That's why he's been so quiet. He's been on Twitter. So yeah, Brad, what platforms are you on in terms of networking for, like, as a PhD student?
So I'd say, firstly, I agree with Joe that podcasts are the best form, because I think since I started my PhD, I've learned the most about other people's research, like across the country and across the globe from listening to podcasts as opposed to like Instagram. But yeah, I mean, I mainly use Instagram. I think the main reason for that is going into this, it was the platform that I was most comfortable with. So like Twitter, I've never really used, even in like a personal sense. I've never had a Twitter account, but I've always used Instagram. And I think unlike Twitter, it's the most like sort of diverse platform. So if you want to put a post up with a big caption and basically have it mainly as text or like an infographic, you can do that. If you want to speak to the camera and post something on your story, you can. And I don't think you can't do a lot of that with Twitter, right? Or with these other platforms. So I think it's just how like diverse the platform is. And also the fact that you can be yourself on Instagram. Whereas, especially if I'm like, speaking with you guys, Twitter is very much more, I don't know how to put it, it's more formal as a platform for academia, right?
We find it quite a scary place, me and Liv.
but Instagram,
we've spoken about that before. We find it quite scary on Twitter. You feel like you have to be a really professional version of yourself. Whereas on Instagram, you can definitely much, much more be just you.
Right, but like especially on New Year's Eve, I noticed within like the academic space, you could see people putting their stories up where they're drinking and having fun, right? You wouldn't get that on Twitter, and you'll get to see the other side of these PhDs and what they do outside of just studying. And I think that's just really
like, I'm guilty for that. I definitely did that on New Year's Eve.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's important for people who, like all the undergrads who follow us, it's important for them to look up and see, okay, they're not working 24/7 and speaking formally in every post they put up. Like they're normal people who can have fun and they've got hobbies and you're not like a research drone.
I think especially as we live in a like a society where academia is kind of really normalized to be working ridiculous hours, like almost if anything, if you just do a standard 40-hour week, people are more shocked than if you say like, oh yeah, I worked 80 hours this week. You know, it's, I feel like the focus is kind of the wrong way on the number of hours that people put into academia. And I think that is something that a lot of people feel that something should be done about that. But somewhere like Twitter as a platform doesn't contribute to that, because I remember on Christmas Day looking at Twitter and someone being like, oh, here's a paper that I've had published. And I was like, it's Christmas Day. Like, get on the Bucksfizz and have a nice breakfast. Why are we thinking about research right now? Do you know, I think Instagram does definitely allow you to showcase that normal side of an academic life.
It's the absolute opposite, isn't it? So whenever I've been working at the weekend and I put a story up, I'll get like 5 to 10 messages saying, what are you doing working?
Don't do that.
Right? Yeah, exactly. It's the complete opposite.
Yeah, definitely. It's a much more kind of supportive, in the right direction, I think, supportive of having a normal work-life balance. Whereas on Twitter, I feel like almost if I go on Twitter at the weekend, in the evening, on Christmas, I'm kind of bombarded with people doing work and I think, oh my gosh, I should be doing some work right now too.
Yeah, I agree. And I think like from it, my experience, like a lot of people in my lab, like the other PhD students, and master's students, when I spoke to them about like how I use social media as a PhD student for networking and science communication, they all like their first response is, I hate Twitter, or I don't want to use Twitter, like I don't want my PIs to see everything I'm doing on Twitter. So I guess that was like the motivation behind this podcast, is to I guess like talk about the other platforms.
We're not Twitter bashing, not at all. It is a good platform. I think it's a very important platform, but we personally maybe prefer others. And I guess, we want to talk about what else is available.
Yeah. I think you're definitely right about it being an important platform. And I think every platform is important in its own way. You know, there's different audience on every platform. There's people I can reach on Twitter that I will never find on Instagram.
Yeah.
And likewise, I mean, we were saying when we had this chat beforehand that like us four wouldn't have met and we wouldn't be having this conversation right now obviously if it wasn't for Instagram. So I think each platform is important in its own way. But just sort of like before we get I guess ahead of ourselves on speaking about like all the different platforms. I wondered, and I think we got a question about this actually as well, is what were your motivations for starting, I guess, or making these profiles for your science communication? Like, what made you think, okay, I'm going to go and start an Instagram account or a Twitter account?
Or a podcast.
Or a podcast, yeah. Or YouTube, in Joe's case. Joe does it all. He is, like, the social media
communications expert.
No.
Yeah.
Far from it. Well, first of all, I think let's just say the importance of Twitter first. I think that, because there's definitely benefits to Twitter. And yeah. With that, it's great for looking at what people are publishing, and especially if you're inspiring to be somewhat in academia, such as a lecturer or even a professor at one point. Twitter does have a lot of studies. I don't know if you've both seen my Twitter, but I've just shared so many studies. Because one thing I like to do is just scroll through the day, and I'll just share studies I can read on the weekends or in the week and stuff. So that's why I enjoy it. I think it's great for seeing publications. But I agree as well with what you were saying, Ellie, is it's not really a realistic platform for seeing what people are doing day to day. Whereas what Brad was saying with the Instagram, you can put the videos, you can put stories and that kind of stuff. So it's a more realistic platform to see day to day what people are doing. And that's great then, because then people can really share what it's like. Because in Twitter, you don't see the negatives. Or sometimes you do, actually, but not as much as you would on Instagram. I think Instagram, it's a lot easier for people to share if they've had a bad day, if something's not gone right. And the support's always there. You always see in the comment section, or, hope you're feeling better, da, 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 da. But you can also show the positives. And people will learn from both. I think that's the main thing. And that's the beautiful thing with social media is, it's good just to put as much as you can out there. Because people will learn from anything, really, that you're doing. But yeah, sorry, answering your question. So for me, I follow a guy called Ali Abdal. I don't know if you've both heard of him. Or three of you have heard of him, no?
No, yeah. I haven't.
You heard of him, Brad, yeah.
Yeah, he does like the how to revise videos and stuff, doesn't he?
Yeah.
The Cambridge Medic.
That's it.
Yeah.
Oh, on YouTube?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
He's just... Because I met him before Christmas. I managed to arrange a coffee meeting with him, and I literally spoke to him for like 2 hours long about all this. And he mentioned a book called Show Your Work. The book just talks about the importance of putting yourself online and building yourself a serendipity train, it's like to be called. And it's just talking about building your own luck. And I feel like with research, or especially as PhD students, like keeping your work to yourselves or what you're doing every day, you're limiting yourself. Whereas if you put stuff on your social media, you just don't know who you're going to talk to, who you're going to meet, and you just got more chance of, trying to get a job after, or like in this case now, we've all managed to arrange this podcast. If we haven't been putting out stuff on social media, this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
So I think stuff like that shows the importance, and that's why I started it.
Yeah, so I think I might have spoken to Joe about this when I was on his podcast as well. I can't really remember. So I'm the newest PhD out of all of us, right? I only started in September.
Yeah, still a baby.
I'm still a PhD baby, getting pulled around the lab by the postdocs. Yeah, so I wanted something to sort of keep me accountable. And that was the main thing for me, is I thought, especially at the start where I knew I was going to be doing a lot of like boring reading at home, I thought if I have this account where I'm showing people what's happening, it's going to keep me accountable and I'm going to keep on producing the work.
Yeah.
And I was sort of tentative about starting one, but at the same time, one of my friends who I did my undergrad with, she's just started a PhD at Oxford, and she made an account and she just sort of said, go for it. So I made one off of the back of that. And I had no idea about this academia Instagram community. I didn't know it existed or anything. But I found literally within sort of 3 to 4 weeks, like the amount of messages of people asking me about my research, where you have all the threads going along on the stories, people asking how you're doing and what you're doing. I was like, oh, you know, this is awesome. So I think it's sort of that accountability, and then I kept going with it because I realized how awesome the community was, and how sort of supportive everybody is.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a supportive environment, but it's quite motivational as well, isn't it? You know, if you've had a rubbish day, but you're seeing what everyone else has been doing, that kind of inspires you to have a better day tomorrow.
It's basically the complete opposite to what the rest of Instagram is, where it's really toxic.
Isn't it?
Just an awesome community with the young academics.
On that point that you've just said about young academics, perhaps maybe if there's any lecturers listening, don't hate me for this one, but I think because Instagram is not populated by, in my experience anyway, people above PhD level, I think that's what really gives the PhDs really the I guess like the chance to actually shine and actually talk about their research, because a lot of the time I feel on platforms like Twitter we are overshadowed by the PIs and the professors who have, you know, way more papers published in our field. And also because they're on Twitter, I feel less inclined to speak about my research because I know that they are on that platform and they could so easily be like, hey, no, that's actually wrong, or that thing you've just said is actually like quite controversial in the field. And I might be aware of that, but I've chosen not to share it on that particular post for, I don't know, because, you know, I'm trying to make perhaps my research accessible in a way, and I'm not trying to get into those debates. So I think that's why Instagram, for me anyway, is a preferred platform, because I think that's not something that I have to worry about. Yeah. I think people are just on there to learn, because we are all like early career scientists, and I think we're all just want to like learn from each other, and we're not there to bash each other or criticize each other. And I think in science, I think I mentioned this last week, we're all sort of conditioned into not bashing each other's work, but kind of bashing each other's work, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're all taught to think about the limitations of things, and like we're all told, okay, go and review this paper, and we have to pick out everything wrong with it. It's not like we're at school and we're given like 2 stars and a wish. It's just it's just wishes. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. I think when you're conditioned like to, yeah, I guess criticize other people's work, it's nice to be on a platform where that's not what we're trying to do. We are actually all just there to learn, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
and
quite
I think
empowering almost.
Definitely. And I think like Brad, you were saying, the difference between kind of regular Instagram and academic Instagram, you know, normal everyday Instagram, you know, we're watching all these influencers out in Dubai living their best lives and only showcasing their best moments. Whereas we, like in the academic sense of it, you use it more to showcase real life, which I think is quite nice. And in the same way as you would look at normal people and you'd be like, oh, they're living such a great life. They're on holiday, they're doing this, they're doing that. Why aren't I doing that? You use the academic Instagram as like, oh, so-and-so's had a really good day in the lab, I should work harder tomorrow. It's a different kind of jealousy, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Like I think Joe was saying, the opportunities you can get from being online, letting the academic space know that you're a scientist, you're here, this is what you're researching. I think that's probably the biggest benefit out of all of it.
Yeah.
Or seeing the opportunities that can come from this and people knowing your existence in this space. I think that's a really big, big one.
Yeah. I just think like a postdoc position comes up and everyone's got somewhat similar publications, we've got a PhD in a similar area. I think to somewhat extent, if someone had like their own personal website, as an example, I think they would get the job just because it looks more professional and they're putting themselves out there. And, you know, like online writing and putting stuff on Instagram, I think that's a bit of a skill, especially where academic Instagram is, you know, it's not just you just take a picture and you write out last night, you know, some of the Instagram slides I see, I've learned a lot from them. It's really useful content. We've just in academia Instagram, we've switched the whole idea of what Instagram is, and we've used it for our advantages to teach other people. Like that's amazing when you think about it. So, yeah. And I think in a few years' time, because the community is growing now, I think it'll just open up more opportunities. You never know. Mm-hmm. Maybe postdocs or lecturers will start using Instagram, and then they'll message you, oh, I seen on your thing, you do research on this. Let's have a chat. Let's email me. We can arrange. Mm-hmm. Them sort of opportunities will start coming, in my personal opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
100%.
I think as well, like, I sound a bit like a broken record, and I feel like this is something that I always say, but I think that, Ellie, you're literally going to be like, stop saying this, but like interdisciplinary research and even like within science. Yeah, she's thinking, shut up. But even like within science, right? Like, I think we're at that stage perhaps in research where all of the basic questions have been asked, right? And I think most of, I mean, that's again a controversial thing to say, but I can say that definitely in my research, the basic questions have been answered. So now I'm trying to tackle all of these really complicated questions that require me to not know just perhaps about epigenetics. I need to know about social science and a lot about statistics and just a ton of different things come into it. So I think this is where things like Instagram come in handy, because I can easily read about other areas of research, and let's say in 20 years of me interacting and reading posts from people that I perhaps wouldn't have done if I wasn't on social media will benefit me. I don't know what you guys think on that. And I think as well, you're really right about gaining a skill. This is something that I always say, is that I've gained a skill from being on social media by being able to and practicing like communicating my research in an accessible way and presenting my research to people who aren't in my field and making it so that they can understand it.
Yeah, and I think, like you touched upon, Joe, kind of turning round perception of social media. I think often social media has very bad reputation. I know, so kind of two things that cross my mind on that. One, yesterday I was saying to my family about how me and Liv are filming a podcast tomorrow with these two guys that we met on the internet, and my family are like, but like, it's the sort of thing where we would not have come together had it not been for social media. Especially at the moment, there is obviously a huge lack of in-person conferences and meetings and that sort of thing. So social media is a chance for, like you're saying, Liv, interdisciplinary research to come together. But also, I think often you get told at school, be careful of what you post on your social media. You don't want to post anything that you wouldn't want your future employer to see. Whereas, if anything, we're now using our academic social media platforms as proof of how good we are, rather than being careful about what we want to hide from our potential future employers. I think it's more like look how good I am at science communication, rather than ignore the fact that I was drunk last weekend.
Yeah, because that should be the whole point of doing research. If no one knows about it, then you need to share it out. You need to, and that's what Instagram does. I think anyone who doesn't know about our, say, research kind of group on Instagram, they're always going to have that perception first. Gosh, you know, these people are doing PhDs. Surely they're putting themselves at like risk of, you know, what the future employee is going to be looking at. But when they actually see the content we're putting out, it's not as if we're talking about random stuff. It's good science communication, just in a more easier way. I think Instagram's a really easy way to use it, so that's what I think.
It's accessible, isn't it? That's the
yeah,
I think that's a big point as well, is it's and so easy to read on other people's niches and areas I would have never read about myself. And like Liv was saying, with the, it's interdisciplinary as well, it's just a good bundle of everything.
And I think something as well that younger people are more interested in. I know full well, if I told, say, my younger cousin who's in her first year of college, if I said to her, oh, go follow my Twitter and look at all the research papers that I'm retweeting, she'd be like, no. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I followed her on Instagram, she'd follow me back. You know, I think younger people have that kind of affinity for newer social medias. And we were talking a little bit about this the other day, weren't we, Liv? Like TikTok is the next one that we think's coming up, and younger people are more interested in that. You go into school and do school science communications, tell them all to go follow you on Instagram, they will. Tell them to follow you on TikTok, they will. Tell them to follow you on Twitter, they'll be a bit like, really?
Yeah, definitely. I think it comes back to, you know, what I was discussing in my talk the other week as well. I think less people are going to be interested in reading my paper than, like, more people are going to be interested in just seeing what I do on a day-to-day life. Like, what I think misconceptions about scientists are, like, very real. And I think, like, the general public don't realize what scientists do, and, like, that we are, like Brett said, like, we are real people. Do you know what I mean? So I think people are more interested in seeing what I do and just, I guess, my day-to-day activities than perhaps the research that I produce. But on that point, I also think that putting yourself out there on social media and allowing people to watch your journey and, I guess, building your research community at the same time does lead to more people being interested in reading your research paper. Does that make sense? Yeah. Like, more people are going to be likely to download my paper and read it, perhaps who aren't in my field, but also people who are in my field, because they've sort of watched the whole process towards me formulating that paper.
Like, Liv did a talk the other day about the importance of social media. She did a departmental seminar. I think one of the quotes that you put up was about, like, if you want to get your work and your research well known, you've got to already be famous. Know someone, like your supervisor, be famous. And I know that obviously calling yourself famous for having an Instagram is a little bit narrow-minded. You know, obviously you're not famous, but you're putting yourself out there, aren't you? And that's people are going to be interested in you if they know your story, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they will definitely read your research paper.
That was Dan Quintana, just to credit that tweet, because he does a lot of talks about like surrounding this topic, and he's a really great science communicator. And I think if anyone's interested in hearing more, they should definitely go to his Twitter and read some of his stuff. I think he's also wrote a book about how to use Twitter for scientists, but he does a lot of posts. And another one of his great quotes that I put on that talk was the whole worry of, I don't have anything to post. I don't know what to post. Like, I'm not going to start it because what am I going to post about? I don't have any papers and stuff. And one of the messages that he also drives home is to, I guess, share the process towards the paper and not just the paper.
Yeah.
Going back to what you said a minute ago about changing, like, the public's perception on what we do as scientists, that's never been more important than the last 12 months. COVID and the public trusting what we do as scientists. And one way that we build trust in scientists is by them understanding what we actually do day to day. Like, my family, they don't have, you know, before I started the Instagram, my family didn't have any real idea about what I actually did day to day. And it's only through them seeing, like, the stories that I put up and the videos that I put up of what I'm doing in the lab and the process, where they've started to understand that. And I think this could be such a key thing for the rest of the population to sort of get a bit of as well.
Especially as obviously there was all that skepticism surrounding, like, well, how can this vaccine have been developed so quickly? And scientists were coming out and saying, you know, the actual amount of work that it takes to develop a vaccine, actually, obviously it's a huge amount of work, but actually in a time frame isn't that long. It's funding and all of the red tape that actually slows the process down. So in a massive crisis like this, throw all the resources that you've got at it and it can be done really quickly. But obviously the general public's perception a lot of the time is like, oh no, normally that takes years and years. So I think it is important to be communicating exactly what goes on in research to the general public.
I think as well, there's so many interesting people out there that are in research or even studying a PhD, and if they just stay in research, unless we get to like the top level, like you say, in as a professorship, you don't really get heard of. So I agree with you. I think once, especially like people like yourselves, who have both got, the three of you have got a good fan base on Instagram. You know, you've got people following what you do on a weekly basis. And I guess you can kind of control that in a way to work for you. And what I mean by that is, if you've got a lot of followers, then when you publish a paper or something, the chances of it being read is going to be so much more because you've got that following.
Yeah, definitely. And another thing that I spoke about in my talk, which again was from Dan Quintana, was the amount of like gatekeeping that we have in academia. And
yeah,
just on like when Ellie mentioned the quote about the way to get your research known is to have a famous mentor, be famous. The other one was to repeatedly win the peer review lottery.
Yeah.
So something he spoke about and I spoke about in my talk as well was when we all write our papers, right, we spend sometimes years writing our papers and getting all the data and everything, and we submit that paper to a journal. Essentially, when you think about it, there's one editor who decides whether your research is worth sharing with the rest of the community. And that is sort of a lottery in itself, right? So I guess then if they decide like, okay, this research is worth sharing, it then goes on to three reviewers who do the exact same thing. So essentially you have four people deciding whether your years, several years worth of work is worth sharing. Mm. And my personal opinion is that the pros outweigh the cons, because I know a lot of people are really skeptical about sharing their research online because is my research, you know, going to be copied? Are my ideas going to be taken? Are people going to see what I'm doing and they're going to do the same thing? And I think that's like a very reasonable worry to have, but I think it's something that you can take into account when you think about what you're sharing. But for me, I think the pros outweigh the cons because, like I said, you literally do have these four people, right, who are sharing, like just going to say, okay, yeah, this research is good enough to share with the community. And as much as I agree with the whole peer review process and I think it's necessary, I think my research is worth sharing. So I'm going to share it before that paper is submitted. I don't want someone else to decide that for me.
I think it is important, this whole podcast is about putting ourselves on social media. I do think there is somewhat, you can't always share. Do you not agree with that?
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was saying. There's some things that I mean, I don't share all of my research. You guys know what I research, but no one knows how I do it.
Yeah,
and yes.
I'm trying to get that.
Yeah, I wouldn't share exactly all of the steps. And I think that's what I'm saying when it's up to you how much you share, because each PhD and each, I guess, paper is different in terms of how much is a good and like, I guess, how much is a good idea to share. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a decision that only we can make as researchers.
One of the things I like that you both said, this was on my podcast, the first ever one I did, and you both say when you put stuff on social media, you feel like you have to be productive. That's what I found quite funny as well, because if you're advertising it, you have to actually do it. So I think that's another positive as well.
It's faking it till you make it. Like, you have to pretend to be productive to the point where it actually becomes easier to just be productive than pretending to be productive.
I mean, that's the whole reason Brad started his account, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not the most productive
make
person.
Make you work.
I'm pretty lazy. So I thought if I could start this, then it's going to make me be productive. And hey, it has, sort of.
Yeah. It's more people than just your supervisor that are expecting to know what you're doing and where you're going. I think it's a bit more of an informal way of, like, mini presentations, isn't it? You know, I quite like, me and Liv both like volunteer. Well, do we like volunteering? I don't know. We often volunteer to do seminars within our genomics group.
Everyone is so fed up of us.
They are fed up of us.
They're so sick of hearing about our research. It's like not even funny.
It forces you into having a productive few weeks because you're like, oh, I've got to prepare for this talk that I'm giving. So you have to be productive. Whereas I think sharing your work on social media is like a a smaller scale of that, you know, you've got to show your work more often. So it does force you into being productive.
How do you guys find time for social media?
I just sort of wing it, to be honest.
Just wing it, just do it whenever you have time, some people
sort of, they make content in advance, right, and they plan out. I don't know if you guys do that or not.
I do that.
I'd like to do that, but I'm not quite productive enough yet to do that. So maybe in the future, but I just sort of, I'll go like 4 days and I think I should probably do a post now. And I'll come up with, I'll either have a topic that someone's messaged me about or something in my head, then I'll create that. But yeah, I suppose I don't really fit it in. I don't really fit it in around my work because it is my work. So often if I'm doing a post on something, it's been because it relates to what I was doing that week anyway. So I'm not going out of my way to make content.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's different for everyone. And I think, like, for me, I find it easier to plan it out. So, like, on a Sunday or a Monday morning, I'll literally, like, queue up all of my posts. And then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I just hit post. That's all I have to do. And that's, I guess, what works for me. Joe, how do you find it planning your podcast, I guess? Like, how much of, for anyone, I guess, who was thinking about starting up a podcast, how do you find it in terms of time? Do you find that it takes up a lot of your time? Is it worth it?
Yeah, it's definitely worth it. I love the podcast. Like, some of the people I've spoken to, I'm just like, wow, just I get to learn so much. And then the fact that I'm sharing it, people then get to learn what I've learned. So it's definitely good. I just use I've got a Notion template, and I pretty much just write who I'd like to ask next to come on the podcast, and then if they say yes, great. If they say no, then it's not a problem. And then I just try to arrange with them. Then I usually have a meeting with them beforehand, and then record it a week later. But one thing I found now that I've got 12 episodes now. Well, 10 have been published, but I got another two recorded. And because it's starting to get a bit more noticed now, I'm finding like people are coming to me a little bit in a way, just because they might have heard of it or they might have seen it. Someone might have shared it. So for me personally, with the podcast, that's just coming kind of naturally now. It's just grown into my, how can I say? It's become a habit for me. It's not like an additional thing, like Brad was saying. Everything he's doing kind of fits in with his work. And I feel like the podcast is starting to feel like that now. So like, every week I'm like, okay, who am I recording with this week? And then I've booked it. Okay, that's part of my routine next week. And it just goes on definitely. Like that.
I think we feel a bit like that as well, don't we, Liv? Like, we seem to have it where one week we'll do loads and then the next week we have a really quiet week. And last week we didn't really do anything for our podcast, did we? Because we'd kind of done it all in advance.
No,
and we got to last night and we were like, oh my God. Like, I'm excited to get back into it just because it just felt a bit bizarre not having that structure, even though we've only been doing it a couple of months.
Well, for both of us, for three of us actually, because we're relying on other people for the podcasts. I try to just do it on what's easier for them. And then if I've recorded more than I should have that week, because I was quite lucky, like last week I managed to get two. So I'll just post one a week, and then it just saves me time. And then that's on that other time, then I've got stuff to do, stuff for the website, or I need to start getting back into the YouTube as well. So
I was going to ask you about the YouTube. So why did you start a YouTube? What made you want to do that? Because I feel like you hadn't mentioned it before.
Again, so I really liked watching Dr. Simon Clark and Dr. Amina Yonis when I was doing my master's, and watching their videos like day in the life as a PhD student, that really motivated me. That was my motivation when I was doing my master's, because by the time I got to master's, I started to get really bored of just writing assignments and, you know, exams and all that. I just wanted to do research. I wanted to be in the lab day in, day out, and just focus on one specific topic. So when I had people like that to look up to doing my master's, I thought, I need to start a YouTube. But I don't know why, when I was doing my master's, I felt like I don't have the prestige or I'm not that level to start the YouTube channel, which is just absolute nonsense, because everyone's like average. You can start a YouTube channel with everyone. I think people worry about, oh, you won't have stuff to video and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I just got to PhD and I was like, actually, no, maybe I do need to start it now. And obviously after I met that Ali Abdul, it just made sense to me. Yeah, I need to start a YouTube. So that's why.
Yeah, so it's awesome that you met him as well and that he took the time out to speak to you.
Yeah, such a like one of the best experiences of my life. Like, literally spoke to him for like 2 hours, drinking coffee, drinking water, and just literally chatting and just seeing how much his life has changed from starting a YouTube channel and literally just putting himself on social media. It's just amazing. It's crazy how much he's achieved. And I just like his routine of the different people he speaks to and stuff. And that's inspiring in itself.
Do you think your YouTube channel is less of a way of communicating your research and more a more source of self-motivation? Because I think something that I sort of, me and Ellie spoke about this, but something me and Ellie was taught is go online to get your research out there. But I think one of the important things to remember is that it's not all about getting your research out there. It can just, or it should just be sometimes just a source of self-motivation and just a way to talk to other people and like hear about other people's experience. It's not all about science communication and look how great I am, look at this paper. Do you know what I mean?
I think it's a bit of everything, isn't it? I think the science, for me personally, science communication is great because I get to learn off other people and hopefully they learn somewhat from myself as well. But then I think like stuff like the YouTube and stuff, for me personally, it's about, I feel like I've got somewhat of a knowledge in certain areas to put myself on YouTube. But looking back, maybe I should have started in masters. And it's just about developing other skills that I never would have even thought about, like editing a video. My gosh, if you told me about that 2 years ago, I would have just been like, phew. But I know I've only got 2 videos, but like even just editing that was difficult. But it was a new skill I learned. And that's what I like about stuff like with the social media. It's all about it's about developing skills as well as communication.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it comes back to what you said about, you know, when you were speaking about how negative experiences and positive experiences during the PhD offer like value to someone. Mm. So I think like when you mentioned about you felt as a master's student that you wasn't like skilled enough or you didn't have much to give, I guess, just worth remembering that no matter what stage you're at or where you're going, you always have something to give to someone online, because there's always going to be someone in the same boat as you.
Yeah, that is so true. You will always have people will always have more skills than you, but you will always have a skill that someone else might not have. And never too late to start, never too early to start as well.
I think you must feel like that a bit, Brad. Obviously, being in your first year, you know, I mean, I know me and Liv for definite don't have much data at all. Like, we really shouldn't be admitting this, but we don't have that much to show even now in our second year of our PhD. So obviously you being a year earlier than that, you probably don't really have that much to show, but you're still getting a lot out of the experience and you're still being able to share your experience with people. So it's not about how much knowledge and experience and results you've got. It is you've always got something to share.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose a lot of what I've shared so far is all the failures I've had. So it's almost like I'm documenting like the pathway of failures I take until I get a good result, which you might not necessarily get from like a third year PhD where they've optimized everything and they're sort of churning results out at that point.
Yeah.
But I think I hit a perfect point to start mine because I literally started it the week that my PhD began.
Yeah.
So I'm getting the entire time scale from start to finish and sort of the ups and downs at the same time. So I think it's valuable to me to document it. And also I'm learning along the way with it and I'm showing how I'm learning. But to other people who are thinking about doing PhD, I think, especially if, say, like 2 years' time, someone looks at my account and they go back through my feed for the past 2 years, they're going to see what I've done day to day and how I've developed. And sort of what we do, and they can make a a decision on whether a PhD is for them, or that might add towards whether a PhD is for them. So I think, yeah, like Joe was saying, no matter what time you start the start this social media, you're going to gain something from it, and other people are going to gain masses from it as well.
Yeah. And I think also, what a great way for you to, like, you know, revise for any talks that you have to give, like even your Viva, you know, you're going to be able to look back on all your Instagram posts and be like, hey, like, remember when this went wrong? Remember when I had to do this and that? Things that you might forget otherwise.
Definitely, yeah.
I agree with that as well.
It's a bit like a diary.
Yeah, it basically it is an informal diary that you're sharing online, right?
Yeah. What would be your tips to anyone thinking about starting a social media for their research, or even just their studies in general? Because I appreciate that everyone listening might not even be doing a PhD or a master's. So, yeah, what are your tips?
I think a big one is to, and this is quite easy to say but hard to do, is to just be confident and to not think so much about what other people are going to think about you.
Yeah.
So I personally, I'm not the most confident person, and I don't know whether I put that across or not.
No.
But like, exactly. And maybe a couple of months ago, before I started the social media, if we'd done this 4 months ago, maybe this talk would be completely different. But I sort of said from the start, you know, I'm going to be confident, I'm going to put out what I want to put out, and I'm not going to think about what other people are going to say about it. Mm-hmm. Of course, within reason, not putting things that shouldn't be, that would be like stupidly controversial, shouldn't be on Instagram.
I think that's a really great advice from you, because the first way I found your account, or the first time I saw you on Instagram, was actually an IGTV video that you done talking about failure during your PhD. And I appreciate that a lot of people would be really nervous to like put a video up of themselves, because it's like, you know, the era of influencers and everyone sort of like mocks people who do things like that. But I think that's great advice from you, because that is like the way that I found your account.
I had that saved for like 2 months, that video.
And I literally saw everyone sharing it.
Yeah.
And that's how I found your account.
That was almost, I think I was surprised by the response, because even when I started the account, I thought, you know, I'll get a couple hundred followers, like 200-300, and I'll just sort of like interact with people. After I put that out, I gained like 500 followers in a couple of weeks, and like it got such a good response. And that's when I started to think, okay, people want to listen to me. I'm helping people. Yeah, influencer. But yeah, I don't know. It's just going back to how good the community was. Be confident, people. You know, even if you're not good at talking straight away and putting your research across, you're going to improve. Just do it, basically.
Yeah, I think the confidence comes with time as well. I know that, like, on mine, I don't think I even like put any pictures of me on there for like a good couple months. It was literally my desk, and that was it. And I think maybe like a couple months into it, we did a live, didn't we, Ellie?
We did.
So yeah, I think that's great advice. What about you, Joe? What would be your tips?
For me personally, I think it's just getting started. Just the most demanding thing, whether you're starting your own website, you're starting YouTube or your own podcast, whatever it is, I think the biggest difficult or the most difficult thing is just getting started and posting that first video or story. Once you get that first one out and you realize, actually, that wasn't that bad, and people seem to be liking this, it's so much easier then, as Brad said, you build your confidence and you can just keep on going with that. I think sometimes, and people always look for like a perfect post straight away, and I got to appreciate that will just come with time. Like, you've kind of got to go through, I don't know, 50 posts or 50 like videos of which are going to be not as good as what you want to get to that one good one. So it's just about getting the first post out and just being consistent with it, and then just appreciating it'll just come with time.
Can I just add on to that, like exactly what you were saying at the end there, being consistent with it, but that can be completely on your terms, like, you know, whether that's once a month, once a week, once, like, if you're really motivated, like our little social media queen Livy, and post every day, that's amazing. But I think it's important just to be consistent and engaging, you know, in whatever you post, even if that is only every couple of weeks.
Yeah, definitely. Because I get people like say to me all the time, like, oh my God, how do you post every single day? And like, oh, I want to do that. But for me, it's like I said, I like plan everything. And also that's just my own source of motivation. Like it just keeps me motivated, but by no means do you have to post every single day to get, you know, engagement with your content. You can just post like, I mean, I follow people who post like once every 2 weeks and they have just as much engagement as me. I think it's just, you have to just put in as much effort as you want to and don't pressure yourself with it 100%, because I think when you start pressuring yourself with it, that's when you start like not enjoying what you're doing.
Yeah, you've got and to be doing it for yourself, haven't
yeah,
you?
And then, yeah, definitely. And I think you also start putting out stuff that you don't even really want to put out, and then, you know,
you just like, look back on it and cringe.
People will enjoy it anyway, even if you think it's not a great post. And yeah, because otherwise, all you're going to do, if you're just doing posts on stuff you don't really enjoy, you'll just burn out and then you'll stop doing it. So no, I really agree with you both there.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish up with some questions. So obviously we put on our Instagrams if anyone had any questions about any of the topics that we've spoke about today. We have a question here that says, have you had any advantages or opportunities that have come from doing science communication on social media?
This mm-hmm. is a prime example.
What a great example.
I would have never imagined that I'd be on a podcast with like awesome people like you three. Oh. I think this is, yeah, blowing smoke up your ass. yeah, I think that for me, that's been a massive benefit mm-hmm. and an opportunity. I've had researchers sort of within similar fields contacting me asking if they want to collaborate. I've had messages and emails asking if I want to talk at seminars and like early career seminars and stuff like that. I would have never got any of that beforehand, so I think that's a massive advantage.
What about you, Joe?
Yeah, so for me personally, I'm gonna add on to Brad, meeting amazing people like yourselves, like you.
Oh, thank
Stop
you.
It, guys.
Oh, guys, Stop you're making it. Us blush.
Yeah, for the podcast, that's been great. Like, I've got to meet some fantastic people, and just listening to how they got into research, in itself, that's an achievement for me, because it's like, it really inspires me, some people's stories. Mm. And learning about their science, their research, that's great as well. I've had a few, just through the podcast I've done, like, I've spoken to them kind of off recording, and we've actually like sent each other like different protocols, and they've given me some really good ideas for my PhD. So it's actually, speaking to some people has actually benefited my PhD, just by thinking, actually, I probably wouldn't have done that, or I wouldn't have used this certain technique. So, and then yeah, someone sent me a protocol the other day, and even like offered to like send me some reagents, like try out this protein or this. I've had that as well, and it's like, you know, just from talking on social media, just
gets great. You thinking, doesn't it? And someone saying something like, perhaps, like I said, that these are the kind of conversations that perhaps might not go on within your lab group, because you're all sort of in that very niche mindset.
Like the other day, I was having issues with I was doing confocal imaging, and I had issues with the settings, and I had another scientist pop up who uses confocal, and they were like, oh, why don't you try this out? And I tried it out, and I was like, okay, it works. So that's something I probably would have went around in circles for weeks trying to figure it out, but someone in the community came to my aid.
This question, I feel like we've kind of covered, but someone asked, do you feel pressured to create content?
I just agree with what Ellie was saying. I think if you just stick to the routine that suits you. Like, if you're going to compare to someone who's posting every day and you're only posting mm-hmm. once a month, then you're going to feel pressure. But if that's what fits into your routine, then that's fine. I'm not nowhere near as consistent as you three on Instagram, but I don't cry about it. I don't get upset, because that's what fits in with my routine. I can't compare myself to you three. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I think that's the most important thing, is being consistent, but something it's going to be realistic for yourself, and don't worry what everyone else is doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think I have any sort of external pressure. I don't look at other people and think, you know, like Liv posting, like you post a lot more than me still, and I don't sit there and think, oh, I have to do that, or I don't have this opinion that other people think I should be posting. I just have a sort of like internal, not pressure, but like sort of like with, I'm sure we all have it with our work, just like an internal will, yeah. just to either keep your work going or in this case, put content out. And for me, it's sort of, if I, as long as I'm putting something out like solidly each week, like one or two posts, and then I'm keeping people updated on my story, I think that's good mm-hmm. enough for me.
I guess we should wrap it up, and the best way to wrap this episode up is for you guys, I guess, to let us know your social medias and your handles on things like Twitter and that. So if people want to follow you and see what kind of content you guys post, we all, I think, post very different content.
Yeah.
So I think it's, without, again, sounding up ourselves, I think it's good to check out all of our profiles and see how different everyone is. So yeah, if you guys just want to let us know where we can find you and where people can contact you.
Yeah, so my Instagram, I've just created a new account. So Festa Science. So Festa is F-E-S-T-A, not E-R, I'm Italian, .science. And I have my link tree on there. So everything related to YouTube, podcasts, they can find it through there. But find me on Instagram first. And yeah, anyone who's got messages relating to my research my research area and is interested in that, just let me know, or anything else. Yeah, I'll be happy to chat.
Yeah, and mine is, well, two places now. It was one place about an hour ago. the main platform that I'm using is Instagram, like I said, and you can find me, it's just the neuroscientist with a full stop between each word. And then my Twitter is Brad's Research. There's nothing on there right now, but maybe these guys will influence me to start posting on there.
By the time this episode goes out on Wednesday, so 2 days, Brad will have a tweet.
I'll have a tweet.
We promise.
If not, the episode can be your first tweet, Brad.
Oh, yeah, no, that's a banging idea.
Oh, yeah, don't tweet anything. Just tweet this, 10 a.m. on Wednesday.
I can tweet it to my zero followers.
Yeah, okay.
Can I just say as well, thanks for having me on as well. I really appreciate it. It's been great not to be, not great, but it's been quite cool not being the podcast, I'm going to say, director. It's been quite fun coming on as a guest. So thanks for that. Really appreciate that.
Well, we've enjoyed
having you on. Thanks from us, I guess, for inviting us onto your podcast all that time ago, because that kind of, I guess, inspired us a little bit.
100%.
To get on our podcast journey. So mm-hmm. it's been really, really nice having you both.
Play and also,
thank you to hashtag everyone who's listened to this whole long episode.
Cheers. Thank for you. Having me on. Yeah.
And it was our first bonus episode, so.
So that's exciting in itself.
Yeah. Absolutely. But yeah, no, these are topics that me and Ellie are, like, I guess, really passionate about covering.
But don't necessarily fit with our normal kind of heavy genomics theme.
Yeah, definitely. Perhaps the unspoken things that go on in academia. So yeah, thank you guys for coming on.
No, thank you. Loved it.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
So yeah, we'll see everyone in the next episode, which is going to be a normal episode. Back to genomics.
Back to some hardcore science.
Back to the fun stuff. So we'll see everyone next Wednesday in the next episode.
Yeah, thanks so much, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for joining us for this episode. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at The Genomics Lab. That's got a capital G and a capital L.
You can also find us on Instagram at A Genomics PhD. And finally, be sure to subscribe to us on your favourite podcast platform.
And we will see you all in the next episode. Thank you again for listening.